Well, we find ourselves this week in Genesis chapters 10 and 11, and there are a lot of great commentaries on chapters 10 and 11 that divide up these people groups. This is a wonderful chapter to study if you just want to know more about world history and how we all got here and where we came from after the flood. And if you look at chapter 10, how it's constructed, it goes like this. These are the descendants of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Sons were born to them after the flood. And then it's going to take the sons of Japheth in verse 2, the sons of Japheth, and list them, and then list their sons, and goes on down, list their sons. And then when you finish the line of Japheth, you will see in down in verse 20, these are the descendants, I'm sorry, not 20, but in verse, Japheth finishes up right in verse 5. And each according to its language, by their families, in their nations. And we'll see that Japheth, if you count them, Japheth has 14 descendants that became 14 people groups. And these people groups all settled in the area of Europe. They all settled in the name of Europe. And if you do some word studies, you can actually trace which people group in Europe came from which son. For example, one of them listed there in verse 2 is Javan or Yavan. We know that as Greece. And the Greeks sometimes refer to themselves as Yavan. It's still a Greek word. When you come down to verse 6, it says the sons of Ham, and then it lists the sons of Ham, Cush, Mitzrayim, Phut, and Canaan, and then each of their sons. And that continues on down through verse 20. And you'll see that the sons of Ham, that there are 30 generations there, 30 people groups that descended from Ham. And these settled in the area of the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, Africa. In fact, if you look closely, I want us to look at verse 6 just for a moment. The sons of Ham, his four sons, were Cush, Mitzrayim, Phut or Put, and Canaan. And these four groups we can identify with great specificity, which is a word I really enjoy to use in conversation. Cush is the father of the black African nations. Mitzrayim is the father of the Egyptians. In fact, the Hebrew word for Egypt is Mitzrayim. Phut is the father of the Arabic peoples. And Canaan, of course, is the father of the Canaanites. And this is the son of Ham that Noah cursed, if you recall from a couple of weeks ago. And when you read about the children of Israel going into the land of Canaan and the names of the people groups that live there, you'll hear about the Jebusites and the Amorites, the Girgashites, the Hivites. These are all descendants of Canaan. Okay? So these are all Canaanites. They descend from that. So there are 30 people groups that come from Ham. And then in verse 20 it says, these are the descendants of Ham by their families, by their languages, in their lands, in their nations. And then verse 21 introduces us to Shem. This is where we get the word Shemitic. And anti-Semitism is actually anti-Shemitism. And one of the people groups are the Jewish people that come from this group. These are the ones who settled in Asia. There are 26 of them, 26 people groups. And one of those, of course, are the Jewish people. So we're going from the Middle East on to the Far East. The sons of Japheth are a little bit in the Middle East and on up north and west into Europe. And the sons of Ham are some in the Middle East and then, of course, on down into Africa, Saudi Arabia, in that direction. But they all have little remnants right there around the land of Israel, because this was the heart around Israel and modern Iraq and so on. So it's a fascinating study to go through here. Even you see the Chinese mentioned in verse 17. When you see the word Sinite, S-I-N-I-T-E is probably how it's spelled. This is a word that means the Chinese. So they're even found in here. Now, that's all we're going to say about the people groups. If you add all these groups together, it comes up to 70 nations. 70 nations in all. And so in Judaism, whenever it refers to the 70 nations, it's referring to the Gentile world. The whole Gentile world. And you'll find that number 70 in some interesting places. We see Noah's sons their three sons giving birth to all these other sons, grandsons, great-great-grandsons, and so on, to fill the world with these 70 people groups, 70 nations. But in the book of Exodus, we find a family of Jews going down into Egypt. How many were there? 70. And then later, Yeshua sends out disciples into the cities of Israel. How many does he send? 70. And then on Sukkot, every year in Sukkot, how many bulls would they bring over the 7 days of Sukkot to sacrifice for the nations? 70. 13 the first day, 12 the next, 11 the next, and for 7 days, you add them up, comes to 70. They would make these sacrifices, the Jewish people every year, for the sake of the nations. So it's, when you see that with number 70, think back to this. 70 languages, 70 people groups, 70 nations of people. Now, let's back up. Let's go back to chapter 10. And I would like us to home in on verse 8. It says, "And Cush begot Nimrod. He was the first to be a mighty man on earth. He was a mighty hunter." In Hebrew, that's Gibor Zayid. Gibor means great. Gavura is a word for power. Gibor, big, great. He was a great man. He was a hero. And he was a Gibor Zayid. Zayid means a hunter. It could be a hunter, a trapper, or a fisher. The word Zayid means to take in an animal or a person and catch them. However that's done. Whether digging a pit and camouflaging it, throwing a hook into the water, setting some kind of a trap, using a bow, whatever you use, that's Zayid. Later we'll read about how Isaac enjoyed the Zayid that Esau would bring him, the hunting that he would bring. Esau was a man of the field, and he would go out and hunt. He would kill game, and he would bring it. And this hunt, what he would bring in, is called the Zayid as well. So Zayid is the hunting. And what we're going to find here with Nimrod is something fascinating, because Nimrod was the first example of government on earth. And it is an example of what all governments tend to gravitate toward, and that is tyranny. We live in a very unique land, and I believe with all my heart that our founding fathers were supernaturally wise. Supernaturally wise. Because when they founded this country, they wrote documents in the Constitution that put very, very, very strict limits on the government to keep the government small, to keep the government out of our hair. And then within that, they put balances to make sure that it stayed that way. And it's worked pretty well for a couple hundred years. Unfortunately, as we see the government get bigger and bigger and bigger, we see our freedoms diminish and diminish and diminish. So gradually that when I say that, you might think, well, I feel pretty free. Trust me, you're not as free now as you were 50 years ago. And so all governments tend towards tyranny. Ours is as well. So we're going to see that the model for all government, the model of human government, is right here in the story of Nimrod. And as we unpack this passage of Scripture, it has much to say to us. But the things we say about Nimrod can also be translated in another way. Because you know, whenever you want to understand something in Scripture, you go back to the first time it's referred to or the first time it's described. And this is our first description of government. And so we can read this passage in one way, we can see tyranny. And then we're going to read the same passage again, and we're going to look and see how it refers to King Messiah. And how Messiah is also a hunter. Did you know that Messiah is a hunter? Okay, that's a little teaser to keep you listening. All right. So, it says he was like Nimrod. He was a mighty hunter before Adonai. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before Adonai. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel. Now, throughout Jewish history, Jewish legend, Jewish theology, It always speaks of Nimrod as a tyrant. In fact, I could read a whole list of quotes to you. I'm just going to read one to describe this. This is by the great Torah commentator Rashi, who lived in France, and I think about the 12th century. Rashi wrote, "Nimrod would ensnare people's minds with his mouth, and then destroy them, and lead them astray to rebel against the omnipresent." I actually misread what I wrote here into the shadow of the mic. Let me read that again. "He would ensnare people's minds with his mouth and lead them astray to rebel against the omnipresent. Therefore, it is said regarding any person who behaves wickedly with impertinence, who recognizes his master, yet sets his thoughts to rebel against him, it is said, this one is like Nimrod." Now, if we look at the very name Nimrod, it's very revealing. The Hebrew verb for rebel is the verb marad, marad, mem resh dalet, marad. You put a nun in front of that, it becomes Nimrod. He's the head rebel. He is a head rebel. And so everything about Nimrod is rebellion. Rebellion. Going against the grain. And the sages tell us that when he did this, he used it by using groupthink and using religion. Always a mixture of the two. You know, whenever you find religion, you find groupthink. You find cloning of the mental process. And this is why God has a very dim view of religion. And that may sound odd, come from a guy who's supposed to be a religious leader. I don't look at myself as a religious leader. I'm just a teacher. And as long as people want to listen, I'll sit up here and talk. I'm not a religious leader. But there is only one religion, if you want to call it that, that was ever instituted by God. And it's the religion found in the Torah. Again, if you want to call it a religion. The Jews don't even have a word for religion. It's just that God came to them. He made a covenant with them. And he says, "These are my words. You do them, you'll be blessed. If you don't do them, you won't be blessed. But I'll take care of you. You are my children. You may abandon me, and I'll have to issue some pain to you, and I'll have to bring some discomfort into your lives, and I will bring you back, but you're my people. And this is how you live. Here's the handbook of being my children." And through Messiah, the 70 nations, anyone who by faith wants to be grafted in is grafted in. We all come into these blessings. Other than that, there's no religion constituted by God. It doesn't exist. It just simply does not exist. So as we read through this, we see that Nimrod was a great hunter before the Lord, Lifnei Adonai. That can be read a couple different ways. Lifnei Adonai has a negative connotation and has a positive connotation. Most of the time, just positive. Lifnei means before the face of. Hene is the word for face. Lifnei means toward the face of Yadhevate. But it can also mean in defiance of, in the face of Yadhevate. Okay? Did you ever have somebody get in your face? It's not pleasant. But you remember the first time your spouse or future spouse kissed you? Well, that getting in your face isn't so bad. But both of them were in your face, so to speak. You understand? So, lifnei can have a positive connotation, a very negative connotation. I hope that wasn't a distracting example for anybody. I'll probably hear about that from Robin when she listens to the tape. But I want to share something else with you. We're going to do a little Hebrew lesson here. There's the word for Babel. The beginning of his kingdom, it says, was Babel. Babel is how it's pronounced in Hebrew. It's spelled Beit Beit Lamed. Now, for my Hebrew students, what happens if you take that word and reverse it? Lamed Beit Beit. What does it spell? Heart. Very good. Lavav. Heart. They can be pronounced Lavav or Labub, which is the sound a heart makes. Labub, 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 right? And in Hebrew, many of the words, we'll see another one in a moment, where the pronunciation of the word describes the sound that that thing makes. For example, the words horse is sus, sus. And that's kind of, you use your imagination, that's kind of the sound the horse makes. Soos. All right? You know, that's a sound they hear. And at least in Israel, that's what they hear when a horse does whatever the horse does, when it goes soos. So, but we learn from this that Babel, which means confusion, comes from a backward heart. See the picture? When your heart is straight, when it's yashar, when it's straight before the Lord, confusion goes away. Confusion goes away, and there is peace. When a person places their faith in God, there's a chain of events that happen. When you place your faith in God, you're led into truth. And when you know the truth will make you free. That kind of freedom brings peace, serenity, anger washes out. But when you don't place faith in God, when your heart is backwards, what happens is that you don't have that peace. You don't know the truth. And you're not free. You don't experience peace. And when you don't experience peace, you experience anger. Because there's fear. Wherever there's fear, there's anger. And it's a package deal. These all lead one to the other. Lack of faith leads to not knowing the truth. It leads to a lack of peace. It leads to fear. It always results in anger. And anger often turns into some kind of violence, whether against someone else or against yourself. It's good to have a straight heart, a levav, one that is open toward the Lord. And you feed your mind upon Him. I was listening to a rabbi on the way over here. And he was talking about these great sages of history, the ones of the past generation. And it talks about their panim, their faces. And they had a light about them. They had a glow about them. He said, if you could ever see one of these men, he said, you'd notice two things. You'd notice the wrinkles. You'd look at see the seriousness there because these men had suffered greatly. And they were holding their people together, their congregations together, in the face of a world that was trying to rip them apart. And the world would try to rip us apart. The world would try to rip you apart, your family, your marriage. It'll do everything it can to rip you apart. He says, but when you look at these men, you also see a very, very deep serenity. Because when it comes to the problems that they can deal with, of building their own lives and building truth into the people around them, they're all over it and they pour themselves into all their energies and their time. But when it comes to the world, they don't worry about it. It's not their problem. You see, trying to fix the whole world is not your problem. God's in charge of the world. He's in charge of the real estate of this planet. The real estate you're in charge of is what you wear and live in. It's your body. This dirt that your body's made of. That's the real estate you own. That's the real estate you're in charge of. You're to be king of and rule over. You don't have to worry about the rest. And if you do that job, if you be the man, the woman God wants you to be, if you do the specific detailed things He wants you to do, you do the small things He gives you to do, you know what you do? You bring tikkun to the world to a degree you can't imagine. You know, I grew up, it seems so funny now, I would grow up and I would go to meetings and revivals and so on, and there was always a pattern, especially if it was a youth revival, some kind of a youth meeting. The guy come in and work the crowd and says, we're going to change Akron. And then Akron's going to change Ohio. And Ohio's going to change America. And America's going to change the world. We all go crazy. But there's nothing there about me changing me. That's the work God's given me to do. That's my work. Is to build myself. To work on my soul. That's your job. You know? Don't worry about the world out there. You work on you. And if you're faithful in the small things, God will lead you to the next thing and the next and the next. But God runs the world. He wants you to run you. There's the handle. You follow what I'm saying? Focus on the small things. Do those well, and you'll be amazed at how those little things will change the big things. So focus, focus, focus. Let's go on a little bit more. It says the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. I want you to look at the word king. The word kingdom and the word king come from the same word. Malak is king. Malkut is kingdom. And the word to reign is the word malak. Melech is king, malak is to rule, and a malkut is a kingdom. They all come from the same root. Now, what's interesting about these three letters is that they're found all together, but in reverse order in the middle of the alphabet. Instead of finding mem, lamed, kaf, when you're going through the alphabet, you go on up, you come to yud, and it's kaf, lamed, mem. And the word king is right there in the middle, but hidden. It's backwards, right in the middle of the alphabet. But another unusual thing about these letters is all of them can serve as inseparable pronouns. I didn't get any amens when I said that, I noticed. They serve as... Thank you, Ken. As inseparable pronouns. Now, my Hebrew students all remember what inseparable pronouns are. An inseparable pronoun is kind of an odd thing in Hebrew. In Hebrew, you can take a root and you can stick letters onto the front and it changes that word into more words. You can stick letters onto the back that change it more. They just kind of take a root and they keep sticking things on it. And each of these letters is a sticky letter. It can be stuck onto the front of a word to make that word into two words or more. For example, whenever you take the word, the letter mem, which is the first letter of Melech, king, you take the letter mem, you stick it onto a word, it means from. For example, bait is house. Mabait, put a mem on the front, means from the house. You see? Shemaim is heaven. Mashemaim means from heaven. You get it? All you do is stick mem on it, and you got with, or a from. If you stick a lamed on the front of a word, it means to or toward. Labait means to the house. Mabait means from the house. You got it? We're just singing praises, La Adonai, to the Lord. And then Kaf. And by the way, the last letter of Melech is a Kaf. They look different. This letter that looks like a horizontal vertical line is the same letter as this. But whenever this letter appears at the end of a word, it changes shape. But it is the same letter. Kaf means like or as. All right? You just stick it on the front of a word. Ka, put the word letter, the sound ka, on the front of a word, it means like or as. The sages look at this, and they tell us that these three letters and what they mean as words tell us what a king is all about. Everything flows to this people from the king. Everything from the people reverts back to the king. And the king should always be an example to his people, so they will want to live like the king lives. And that's our Melech. That's our King Messiah. Everything flows from him and to him. And Paul says, through him as well. Paul might have been thinking about these letters. But we are commanded to be like him, to imitate him, to be like our king. And when you've got a good king in charge, these are the natural things that he lives out, these three things. It says that Babel was built in the plain of Shinar. Now, this is one of the really stupid things. You might look at Nimrod as being this great hunter, this great leader, this great tyrant, but he was tremendously stupid as well. Because, think about it, they find a valley, right, named Shinar, and then they want to build a tower that reaches to heaven in the valley. If you wanted to build a tower to reach to heaven, you don't build it in a valley. Another thing is, and the sages bring this up, they had this idea at this time that God was going to bring another flood. It had been about 1,600 years since creation. They thought, well, maybe every 1,600 so years, God brings another flood. So what we need to do is build a big tower. We can escape to the tower, or maybe the tower will hold up the heavens so they don't break loose again. Again, if you're fearing a flood, you don't live in a valley. You see, when people practice groupthink, when people are all thinking exactly the same way, when you have thought police saying, this is the way you have to think, you get real stupid real quick in a big way. We become lemmings and we just all go right off the cliff. God is always into individualism. He wants you to be uniquely you, as only you can be, as only you were created to be, as only you were gifted to be. I don't see any two people here who look alike. I don't see any two people here have exactly the same set of gifts and talents and experiences. So why in the world would I want you to all be alike? Well, there's only one reason I want you to be all alike: if I want to control you, if I'm fearful of you, if I want to make you all the same. Because if you're not exactly what I think you should be, you make me uncomfortable and I want you to leave. And that's how massive governments work. And unfortunately, that's how many religious communities work. I know I've referred to this before, and if I'm boring you with it, I'm sorry, but it's such a great example. If you saw the Second Chronicles of Narnia movie, not the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which is a wonderful movie, but the second one, the Prince Caspian movie. In this movie, there's this great battle. How many of you saw that movie? All right. Remember the big battle? What was the difference between the good guys and the bad guys just by looking at them? What was it? Somebody. What was that? The bad guys all looked the same. They all came in wearing the same uniform, the same weapons. They all had these masks on, these silver masks. They all looked exactly alike. They all had the same facial features. They all walked in a line. But here's these Narnians. I mean, they are a motley crew. You know, all shapes and sizes and species. And I thought, C.S. Lewis really had an insight here into what God's people look like compared to what the world thinks we should look like. You know, what a difference. What a difference. But anyways, Shinar. Now, Shinar is made out of two words. If we split the word Shinar into two words, we get the word shin, which means tooth. All right, tooth. In fact, that first letter is called a shin. This letter is called shin. And if you spell the word out, it's shin, nun, shin. And the letter shin is supposed to picture two things. One is, of course, a tooth. And it kind of looks like a tooth with the root sticking up, right? But shin is also called the letter of fire. The letter of fire. It makes a sh sound and it makes a s sound. It can make either one, like something burning. You might think, well, what in the world does a tooth and fire have in common? It should be obvious. What does it do? It eats. It consumes, right? It consumes things. So, here we have shin, tooth. And over here we have a shortened form of the word ear, which means city. City. City is usually spelled ayin with a yud and then a resh, but this also works. Tooth of the city. In other words, it gives you a picture of a city that consumes its inhabitants. The toothed city, you know? When I was studying this, I was thinking of another letter that has a tooth. You know, the word pay means mouth, and there's a letter called pay. And this is the letter right here, the letter pay. I think most of you are familiar with this letter. I've often referred to it. But the letter pay is a picture of, there's the lower jaw, and there's the top of the mouth, and there's the tooth inside attached to the top jaw. Okay? And this phrase, pen yirbay, comes from the book of Exodus. It's in the first chapter of Exodus. There we found another tyrant who liked people who made bricks. His name was Pharaoh. And when the Jewish people in Egypt began to multiply, he became fearful of them. And he said, let's deal with them wisely or cunningly. And he wanted to place taskmasters over there and enslave them. He said, lest they multiply, pen yirbay. Then you go down a couple more verses, just a couple verses. And it said, they persecuted them, and as they persecuted them, thus they multiplied. There is the phrase, thus they multiplied. Ken yirbay. You see what happened? God pulled Pharaoh's tooth. See? It's gone. And you know what? God's good at taking that old roaring lion who goes around like he's just going to eat you up. He just pulls his teeth. He has no sting. He has no victory. The Word tells us he can't even touch you. And even when Satan wanted to bring fire on Job, he had to go to God to get it. You see, even Satan belongs to God. And I always, if you want to know how to think of Satan, he's God's sheepdog. You're his sheep. Satan's a sheepdog. There is the shepherd. And as long as you're moving with the shepherd, you might be a little to the left, might be a little to the right, a little close, a little bit far behind, but you're in the flock and you're moving with the shepherd, everything's fine. What happens if you start to drift? The sheepdog comes along nipping at your rear. That's his job. Makes you afraid. Makes you panic. Right? It induces a little pain and discomfort at your hindquarters. But it's all good. If it makes you run to your shepherd, he's accomplished his purpose. We have nothing to fear from our enemy. We're never told to fear our enemy. Our enemy feeds on fear, in fact. No, you want a cat to come around, you put some food out. If you want skunks and raccoons or birds or whatever it is, you put food out. If you want Satan around, you put fear out there. Because he feeds on it. That is his pudding right there. He loves fear. And if he can find it, he wants more and more and more. But if you are not a fearful person, the righteous are bold as lions. And if you resist him, he runs from you. He has more to fear from you than you ever have to fear from him. Right? I've never seen a wolf, or for this matter, a lion that carried weapons. All it has are teeth and claws. But God's given us supernatural weapons. And if we keep them on, the enemy's scared to death of us. He wants our weapons and their proper use to be a secret to us. He does not want us to realize the gifts God has given us. And so if he can deceive us into thinking we have something to fear from him, he's accomplished his purpose. But he's also a serpent, and his only weapon is a mouth. He's a liar. The only thing he's invented, the only thing he's really good at, lying. And if he can instill fear, he's accomplished everything. Because if you can fear him, then he can control you. All right, so anyways, there's our Hebrew lesson for tonight. Now, where were we? I actually have notes here to follow, and I don't even know where I'm at on the notes. Oh, I mentioned that he was a hunter in defiance of God. He hunted for men's souls. All the sages refer to this. He hunted and wanted to entrap people. But you know, Yeshua's a hunter as well. This might come as news to you. And you're all familiar with this verse. It's in Matthew 4. Yeshua is walking along the seashore and encounters Peter and some of his future disciples. And he said to them, "Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men." Fishing, something they knew. And these are skills that Yeshua needed. He just had something different to fish for. But when he said that, these men, Peter and these men, would have known what Yeshua was quoting. Yeshua wasn't just coining a new phrase. Fishing for men is something that's found back in Jeremiah. And if you'll turn back to Jeremiah chapter 16, I want to give you a very eye-opening passage here. So you'll see the whole story of what Yeshua was saying. Jeremiah 16, we'll start with verse 14. Jeremiah 16, 14. Jeremiah 16, 14, it says, "Therefore, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when it shall no longer be said, 'As the Lord lives who brought up the people of Israel out of the land of Egypt.' But," this is what they'll say, "'As the Lord lives who brought up the people of Israel out of the north country and out of all the countries where he had driven them.'" Now, let's stop there for a second. the Exodus, which we're about to celebrate next Wednesday night and during the week of Unleavened Bread at our Passover Seders, where God brought his people out of the land of Egypt. God says, there's a bigger thing I'm doing. I'm going to bring my people out of Egypt and Germany and England and France and Spain and every. I'm going to bring them from all the countries to Israel. It'll no longer be said, as the Lord lives who brought the people out of Egypt, but as the Lord lives who brought up the people of Israel, the north country, and out of all the countries where he had driven them. And then what it says, look what it says next. For I will bring them back to their own land that I gave to their fathers. Behold, I am sending for many fishers, declares the Lord, and they shall catch them. And afterward, I will send for many, and the word there is Zaid, hunters. And they shall hunt them from every mountain and every hill and out of the clefts of the rocks. So Nimrod might have been a great hunter. He can't hold a candle to our Messiah. So he's fishing for people to bring them out of the dark into the light. He's hunting for people to bring them down out of the rocks and bring them back to his people. And you know, when Yeshua sent out his disciples, he said, don't go to the lost sheep of the nations. Don't go to the Gentiles. Go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. We're going to fish for the Israelites first. Then later, when he ascended, he said, wait in Jerusalem until you receive the Holy Spirit who's going to empower you to be witnesses to me in Jerusalem and in Judea and Samaria, the uttermost parts of the earth. Right? So he's the fisher first. And the hunter. And he's hunting for souls. Yes, Dale.
I promise Jeremiah about 1660. Book says that I will send for many fishermen. Afterwards I will send for many hunters. I will hunt them from every mountain, the hill, and out of the caves and the rocks. For I see all their ways, and they are not hidden from me. Their crimes are not concealed from my eyes. First of all, they have had trouble for their crimes and sins, because they have spoiled the land, which is mine. They have filled my heritage with corpses and their horrors abominations.
Right. It sounds like an unwanted people. That's a wonderful the rest of the story. If you read the next verses, he starts listing their sins and what they've done. But he's going to bring them back anyway, because he made a covenant with Abraham and with Isaac and with Jacob that he would take care of them and their kids forever. And he's going to bring their kids home. I'm glad we're grafted in, aren't you? And, you know, Yeshua, what did he say? I came to seek and to save that which is lost. He doesn't seek souls so he can consume them. He seeks souls because they're lost. They need found. And he wants to bring them home. That's the kind of God we have. Nimrod wanted to use his people. And Yeshua wants to serve his. He wants everything to flow to them. He wants to set an example for them. He wants to be with them. God wants to be our God. He wants us to be his people. It's a whole different selfless motive that our Messiah has. The exact opposite of Nimrod. Well, we need to move on for the sake of time. Let's go over to chapter 11, because this little blurb in chapter 10 is now opened up more in chapter 11. In fact, in chapter 11, we see this in many ways being addressed not so much as a government, but as a religion. It's almost like in chapter 10, God's given us a picture of what world government looks like. And in chapter 11, as he opens it up, he's looking at the spiritual underpinnings of this and showing us what a world religion looks like. So let's start in verse 1. Chapter 11, verse 1. The whole earth was of one language. One lip is what it actually says. One saha. One lip. And of common purpose. You might say one set of words. It's devarim echadim, which is a very odd phrase. Devarim means words or things. Echad means one. Echadim means ones. It's a plural of one, which is really weird. You know, it's a very odd, confusing phrase, and it's meant to be, because everything about this is odd and confusing. These are an odd and confused people. And it came to pass, when they migrated from the east, they found a valley in the land of Shinar and settled there. Now this, from the east, where have we heard that phrase before? From the east. Yes, but we're in Genesis. The wise men came from the east, but we're going backwards earlier in Genesis. the garden. It says there was a river that went from the garden toward the east and broke into four rivers. There's a lesson there. As you move away from the garden, you begin to break up. Okay? And then it tells about how Adam and Eve were driven away from the garden from the east. And now we see these people who've moved further east, and now they're about to be broken up all over the world. God wants to bring us back to the garden. And to do that, we become more one. Not uniformity, but unity. There's a huge difference. God doesn't work from the outside in, making us all clones. He works from the inside out, making us love one another in spite of the differences. In spite of the differences. And they find the Valley of Shinar and settled there. They said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them in fire. In Hebrew, it's let us brick bricks and fire them in the fire. That's how it reads. And the bricks serve them as stone, and the bitumen serve them as mortar. And they said, come, let us build us a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed across the whole earth. You see something backwards about that paragraph? There's something obviously backwards about this and about these people. Look at the two phrases. Let's make bricks. And then the second phrase, let's make a city and a tower. That's backwards. Normal people say, you know what? Let's make a city and a tower. All right, what should we use? I have an idea. Let's make bricks. That's the way a normal person thinks. But here at the beginning, they're making bricks. What for? Doesn't say. They're just making bricks. Then somebody gets the idea, hey, we have all these bricks. Let's make a city. Let's make a tower. We'll build out. We'll build up. And the sages tell us this is how modern man tends to think. We discover all these little things that we can do. Then we have to find some way to use them. And that's not so bad if it's just gadgets. But where it is bad is when it comes to ideas and religious ideas. Because when we think, when we discover something, oh, look, I learned how to make bricks. Everybody should make bricks. You should do what I do. And that's the problem with world religion and world government. If I think it's a good idea, and I'm the leader, then I want you to think it's a good idea, because I'm going to make you do it. You've got to think like I do. So they make these bricks, then they have to figure out what to do with them. Let's make a city and a tower. It says, come let us build a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves. You know, each of us should be making our own name. And we're promised in Revelation, each of us will be given a new name. Each of us need to have an individual name. But these people wanted all of them together to have one name. You see how this groupthink works? Identical. Clones. The same. And they also were fearful of being dispersed over the whole earth. I mean, think about it. They have a whole world. The whole world open to them. Why do they all want to live in one clump? That sounds like fear to me. You know, the person who's a true individual wants to discover things. He wants to know what's over the horizon. Not just physically, but spiritually. He wants to look outside the box because he realizes his God is vast. And he wants to know him as much as he can. Remember a few weeks ago we were talking about swimming in the sea of Torah? Right? There's no way you can swim the whole sea. So we're all out here swimming, discovering the depths and the riches of the Torah. And you know, David's over there, and Rich is over there, Bill's over here, and they'll say, look what I found. And I look, and look what I found over here. Somebody says, look what I found. Nobody can own it all. We can never experience it all. We just experience the bit we have and share it with others, and we rejoice in that. But it's vast. God's truth is vast. You don't have to be fearful. You don't have to be fearful in discovering what he has for you. Well, verse 5. Adonai descended to look at the city and tower which the sons of man built. Now, why did God have to descend? I mean, he's everywhere anyway. And he wasn't nearsighted. He didn't have to get closer to take a good look. There's the principle here is found in James. You draw near to the Lord, he'll draw near to you. Now that's good and that's bad. If you're drawing near to him in righteousness and love and devotion, he draws closer to you with that loving intimacy and devotion. But if you're trying to draw close to usurp his kingdom and his ways, he's going to draw close too, as two armies are to battle. Not to hug, to fight. So they were building a tower up close to God. Says, all right, I'll meet you halfway. He comes down. And then he says something remarkable here. He says, behold, they are one people with one language for all, and this they begin to do. And now should it not be withheld from them all they propose to do? Or this is where there's a question. Other translations, where there's a statement. Nothing can be withheld from them that they decide to do. This is really interesting because it answers a question that is kind of flummoxed a lot of historians and technologists over the history. And the question is this. Why is it that the technology we have today has all come about basically in about the last century and a half? I mean, there's been a technological explosion. I remember when I was teaching in junior high school, we did a history timeline, technology timeline. We put a line all the way around the room. We started with dates. We started about 6,000 years ago. And we just had dates, like every 100 years, every century, going all the way through time. And I said, I want you guys all pick four inventions. I don't care. Just any invention. Just go through encyclopedia, anything at all. And then I want you to put what the invention was, when it was discovered, where, fill out a little card. Then we started taping these cards on the wall. And then I had like four or five classes, and each kid in each class is doing four of these. We had hundreds of cards on the wall. And it's just this little dribs and drabs of inventions and so on. And then you get to the printing press. Then, boom, it's just an explosion. And then you get to the microcircuit. Boom, another big explosion during this vast flood of technology coming in. The question is, why did it all happen there? All the materials for making paper and a printing press were always available. In fact, the ancient Greeks had actually built a turbine steam engine. Hero's engines. A guy named Hero made it. He also invented the long sandwiches, but those were a bigger hit. But he made this little steam turbine. And he just treated it as a toy. Everybody thought, oh, how cute. And you know, when you look, when the steam engine itself was built, it was almost another 100 years before somebody got the brainstorm, let's put wheels on this thing. They were using this to do work in factories, and somebody thought, you know what, you could put wheels on this and make it go. Why did that take so long to figure that out? But it's incredible. We live in this time of this explosion. What we see here is that in Babel, and then in Egypt, and in Greece, and in Rome, and in Persia, they are always right on the brink of this technological explosion. We could have had men on the moon 4,000 years ago. All the materials were here then, just like they are now. But they were just waiting for that trigger event to allow it to happen. But God wanted to withhold that. He had a timeline. And he prophesied to Daniel that in the last days, knowledge will increase and men will go to and fro. And God wanted this to happen at this time because it's part of the birth pangs of Messiah. The technology we're experiencing today is necessary for the prophecies of Messiah's return to be fulfilled. Okay? But that's I'm really getting on a bunny trail here. So he says, come, let us descend and there confuse their language, that they should not understand one another's language. So God did the very thing that people feared. He dispersed them by confusing their language. And that's where you get the word Babel today. Someone's babbling. It's confused words. It comes from this, the name of this city, Babel. I just want to share a couple overheads with you. And then one ancient source. I'm going to do it very quickly. And if you want to write this down, write fast. Otherwise, you can come up later and you can copy it. One living rabbi calls Nimrod the patron saint of uniformity. He describes two paths to a peaceful society. One is an internal path, one's an external path. One's a path of the spirit and of truth. And the other is external tyranny. In the one case, there's loyalty to truth. In the other case, there's loyalty to a party or to a way of thinking. The internal path is love and practice, whereas the other is fear of retribution. You know, there's a very real political peer pressure in the world today. And if you want to make things just easier for yourself, you just cave into this peer pressure of the media and the reigning political environment. You embrace the whole global warming lie. You embrace the whole one world government is the best lie. You embrace the idea that big government is better government lie. And you embrace these things, and then people just going to leave you alone. Okay, that's what you're supposed to think. Whew, good. But if you think for yourself, you are diminished, you are made fun of, you are marginalized. So it takes guts to stand for truth. If you just want to cave in and not be persecuted, you just buy the lie. The internal path is based on integration. In other words, we're all different. We're all parts of a body, and all the parts look different. But we integrate, that we accomplish great things. The other one is based on uniformity. One synthesis, the other suppression of distinction. People become part of the machine. And Nimrod was the master of this. And world governments and tyrants throughout history have modeled this, whereas God wants us to live this on the left. Blaise Pascal made this great statement. Plurality, that means various differences, different ways of seeing things and doing things. Plurality without unity is confusion. Unity without plurality is tyranny. God wants us to have plurality. He wants everyone to be distinctly yourselves, and yet there to be unity. And where does that unity come from? That unity comes from Colossians 3:14. And above all these, put on love, which binds everything together in perfect harmony. Love. It's an internal thing. Another overhead. This is the second big building project we've seen in Genesis, and I referred to this contrast a few weeks back. On the left, I put the ark, referring to Noah's ark, on the right, the tower of Nimrod. And you want to see the stark difference between God's idea of spirituality and religion and man's idea. What you do is you take these two things, like two halves of menorah, put them side by side, and they shed light on one another. The ark was God's idea, the tower, man's idea. The ark was made out of a living material, wood. The tower is made out of dead material, brick. The ark was built by one family. The tower is built by many. What I'm pointing out from this is that you don't find truth among the majority. You find truth among a minority. The bullseye is the smallest part of the target, but it's the part we should all be striving to hit. The ark was movable, it's mobile. The tower was stationary. The ark is built in obedience to God. The tower is built in defiance of God. The ark looks to the future, the salvation that is ours on the other side of this flood. The tower looks to the past. How can we avoid another flood, even though God promised he wouldn't send one? Noah believed God's warning, but Nimrod did not believe God's promise that there would never be another flood. The ark, its result was salvation. The tower ended in confusion and division. The ark was built in faith. The tower was built in fear. The ark was completed, but the tower was never completed. This is one of the things that just amazes me. The government causes problems, right? And then it says, uh-oh, there's a problem. What should we do? I know, more government. Oh my, we have bigger problems. What should we do? More government. This is the way it is anywhere where there's government. It takes problems that it has created and wants to treat them with more of the same. And it's never done. It never gets finished. It finally collapses in division and confusion, oftentimes death, oftentimes war. God's ways versus man's ways. That's another story. I'm going to read something to you from one of the ancient sources. It's about 2,000 years old. And I came across this in my studies. I was reading to see what it had to say about Nimrod. So I'm just going to quote it to you. And then I want to quote something from Paul. Now, as I read this ancient source, this ancient Jewish mystical source, I want you to try to think what this sounds like. Where have I heard this before? Here's the quote. And it is right there. Let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. They all followed bad advice. Rebelling against the Blessed Holy One, they proceeded foolishly and stupidly. Rabbi Abba said, they admitted stupidity into their minds, but proceeded with evil wisdom, abandoning supernal dominion for the other, exchanging his glory for alien glory. That's the quote. That's the whole quote. I'll read it one more time. Here's the quote. They first of all take the passage out of Scripture, then they comment on it. Here's the quote. Let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. They all followed bad advice, rebelling against the Blessed Holy One. They proceeded foolishly, stupidly. Rabbi Abba said, they admitted stupidity into their minds, but proceeded with evil wisdom, abandoning supernal dominion for the other, exchanging his glory for alien glory. By alien glory, they're referring to satanic demonic forces. Paul almost quotes this, almost word for word. Did anybody recognize where? Romans 1, very good. Romans 1, verses 21 to 23. Listen to what Paul says. And he had to be thinking about Nimrod's generation when he wrote this. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. But they became futile in their thinking, stupid in their thinking. And their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and the birds and animals and creeping things. Isn't that interesting? See, Paul was familiar with this ancient material, and he builds it right into the things he would teach us. And then he goes on into Romans 1 to then talk about another destruction. He's referring to the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah in the next section. And he keeps quoting as he walks through Genesis the destructions that are there. And then he's referring to those in Romans 1. If you buy us to see it, it's all there. Well, anyways, how do we bring this all to a close? Give me some help here, Andy. It comes right there in chapter 10. Yeah, chapter 10 is a little blurb about Nimrod. And then it goes on through the family trees. And then chapter 11, it goes back and says, let's look at this more closely. Yeah. Right. Yes, but chapter 10 starts with Noah's son and traces him on down to the end of that line. It starts with another of Noah's sons, traces it all the way to the end of that line. And then the other son all the way down. So chapter 10 is covering thousands of years. But in the early part of chapter 10, it refers to Nimrod. Okay? So you go to chapter 11 and it homes in on that story of Nimrod then. Yeah. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. Yes, Dia. Absolutely. And what's the opposite of selfishness? Love. All right? We think of hate and love as being opposites or not. Hate and affection are opposites. Hate's an emotion, affection's an emotion. The opposite of love is selfishness. All right? Keep that in mind. Love is doing what's in the best interest of the person, even if I don't feel like it. All right? Not emotion. It's something you do. It's a way you live. Affection is the feeling you sometimes have for the people you love. All right? Yes, Joe.
Archaeologists can dug up a lot of those cities.
Yes.
And all of them were paying attention. That makes sense.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. All the blood breaking. Mm-hmm. Not for 100 or 1,000 years at least.
Yes.
Until the time of Nebuchadnezzar.
Right. That's why Paul brings out the worshiping of birds and animals and creeping things.
Yes.
Because the sages all talk about that, but that was at the heart. Idolatry was at the very heart of everything Nimrod did. Even though it's not mentioned in the text in Genesis, Jewish tradition says there was just gross idolatry there. Very definitely. Yeah. Ken. There's things written about the four rivers, but not in that, those terms. But sounds like you're onto something there. That sounds like it might turn into a good teaching. So make sure he works on that, April. All right, one last comment or question that we close. Yes, go ahead. Sure.
10:25, it says here, and unto Eber were born two sons, one was Peleg, for in his days was the earth divided.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what he refers to as the continental drift?
There, that's the big question. Is that the continental drift, or is that referring to the confusion of the languages? It would seem as the first one, but we don't know. It's a very cryptic passage. The earth is divided up. That's a question I've got. Well, I know we didn't address the very end of chapter 11, which talks about Abraham. We'll start on that next week. We'll get movement of Abraham. Everything in Genesis has been to get us to Abraham. And it seems like everything slows way down when you get to Abraham. I know you're thinking he's been going slow already. But 11 chapters in Genesis covers thousands of years, but the next dozen chapters or so are about one man. It's like the first 11 chapters are how God sets the stage and the props so that he can bring Abraham on the stage and enter into a blood covenant with him. It's an amazing thing to read. So start reading the story of Abraham over the next days, okay? And be prepared for next week's study. Let's close in prayer. Father, thank you, thank you, thank you for this time. And I pray that in all the words and all the thoughts and the verses that we've read, all the things we've said, that your Spirit would weave together something out of this that would be of help to us, be of spiritual nourishment to us, that would enlighten us more. Father, you're such a wonderful and good Father to us. You're so generous. For you are love, you're its very definition. So Lord, help us be like you. Help us not to try to shape others to be like ourselves. But help us to bring out the individual in everyone we meet. So Lord, make us alike in this one thing. That the world will see this one similarity in all of us. That we have love one for another. That's the only thing we need to be identical in. Help us to achieve that one thing of unity. And we will have unity like the world has never beheld before. So we commit ourselves to you this week. I ask your blessing upon the homes as they celebrate your holy Passover this week. May you meet with them at Elijah's seat. And may they sense your presence there in each home. We ask in Yeshua's precious name. Amen.